welcome to Between Mountains and Sea, a podcast dealing with what it's like to be a creative person living in Northwest Wales. This is a short piece about my grandfather. Through the gate, called Checkpoint Charlie, a Cold War chill to keep me safe. A drip of sweat tips the nose. A ribbon, smooth and spokeshave curled, from pale wood. Sawdust in the air. Scent, unmistakable. Light dancing on dust through south-facing windows. The shed. Staves measured, clamped, and marked out with mathematics. Experimental lines in pencil. Boya. An exercise, physics and physical. A brilliant mind. A body with a broken gate. Seeking diversion. My childhood. His shed. Yeah, hello and welcome to Between Mountains and Sea. I'm sitting in the garden as I talk to you now. And yesterday, we went to Chester Zoo, which is working as usual to increase the sizes and complexity of the enclosures for their animals and give them better and better conditions. And obviously is working for conservation in the captive breeding programs for a number of species. The thing that was lovely about going yesterday is I've bought myself a mobility scooter, and consequently I'm sitting here today feeling perfectly happy. My arthritic knees have got worse and worse, and frankly I have to stop at the bus stop between home and the Skerries, which is about 400 yards, to have a little sit down and let my knees recover on the way, which is, you know, it's a bit sad, it's a bit of a shame, it's difficult in many ways, but, you know, you adapt and you move forward and do what you can. So I'm in the middle of a bit of a revelation of how much having arthritic knees has been impinging on my freedom to do whatever I want, and how much I've been cutting my cloth to suit my circumstances. And it's amazing to find yourself saying, I'll go for a jolly. And actually sort of going uptown and what would have been a walk up and around the cathedral and back through the Bishop's Garden and along the High Street, and saying hello to everyone you meet, because I've been here long enough now that and it's a small enough place that I bump into people everywhere I go, which is rather lovely. But being able to do that is something I haven't had for the last two, maybe three even years, where I've been on a stick and having to sit down at every set of public seating I come to. So the freedom to move is gorgeous. What I'm being very careful about is that I keep walking short distances, and I'm not sort of giving up on walking to rely entirely on a mobility scooter, because frankly, you know, that's tantamount to saying, right, I'm not mobile anymore, that's it, and I don't want to do that, and I want to be able to take some exercise, and I want to keep my knees moving and everything else. But yeah, just the joy of being able to go anywhere is fantastic. I'm I wish you could see my face. I'm glowing and grinning as I say this. I mean, I don't know, it might come across in my voice. But yeah, that's something that I hadn't realised how much I was missing, freedom of movement. And now that I've got it back, oh boy, it's fantastic. Anyway, that's by way of a sort of rambling introduction, and I think possibly at that point it's time for a story. This is a short piece about my grandfather. Through the gate, called Checkpoint Charlie, a Cold War chill to keep me safe. A drip of sweat tips the nose. A ribbon, smooth and spokeshave curled from pale wood. Sawdust in the air. Scent unmistakable. Light dancing on dust through south-facing windows, the shed. Staves measured, clamped, and marked out with mathematics. Experimental lines in pencil. Boya. An exercise, physics and physical. A brilliant mind. A body with a broken gate. Seeking diversion. My childhood, his shed. One of the problems with having arthritic knees is it has made it very difficult for me to perform on stage standing up. So for the last year, I've been sitting down whenever I've been performing, which is something I've always avoided. Now, as it happens, it doesn't really affect my ability to breathe properly, because of the way I sit. You know, I'm very upright, and I don't sort of hunch over or anything like that. So I'm not constricting my abdominal capacity and thoracic capacity at all, or any further than playing the guitar already does. But what's been troubling me is it's a change in the way that you engage with an audience. When you are a freestanding rock star, as it were, you have all sorts of body movements that you can use, particularly if you're not singing when you're playing the guitar, or if you are not playing an instrument as a singer. It allows you to run around and pull all sorts of shapes and do things like that. But when you're sat down, it diminishes the space that you take up on stage. You lose all that height, but also you lose the mobility. Now, I mean, I've always been tied to a pedal board and a microphone stand anyway. So my running around, well, in Velvet it didn't matter because I was playing lead guitar and I didn't sing, so I could move around all over the place. But the music had, well, my parts had some quite complicated pedal changes to make the most of those songs, and so I was quite tied down. But yeah, it's something that's been sort of triggering my how am I going to do this. And I think the big thing with a stationary frontman is that you have to increase the intensity and give people a very different experience from the sort of athletic running around and you know, climbing scaffolding or jumping off the top of speakers and hurtling into drum kits. Not that I've ever understood the idea of hurtling into drum kits. For one thing, they're expensive. For another thing, it stops the drummer from playing. And for a third thing, they're covered in big bits of metal that stick out, and it can't be a comfortable landing. But anyway, so I'm thinking very much now about lighting, and about what I say to the audience and how I pace my sets. You know, obviously, this is particularly true of a solo set. You know, in a band format, everyone else can run around if necessary. That's fine as long as there's space, which there often isn't in the Scaries, actually, which is why so many of my singers seem to hurtle out into the audience and sing from there. Let's hear it for good microphones, good speakers, and a clear sound that doesn't feed very easily. but no, that's an aside. So yeah, I'm thinking very much in terms of lighting and of trying to concentrate on other people I've seen sitting down who were magnetic on stage. I think possibly the most interesting of those was C6 Steve. Now, admittedly, when I saw him, he also had a drummer, but the drummer was sat down too. And Steve was sat in a wingback chair with a Fender Deluxe sat next to him and some guitars on, well, some guitars, some not quite so guitars, and some downright not guitars, sitting on stands round him, which he then sort of variously plugged in and out. But the atmosphere at that gig, and that was in the main tent at Cambridge Folk Festival, it was like seeing AC/DC. I've never seen anything like it. Two people sat down playing, and an entire audience leaping about. It was fantastic. So I'm trying to think of ways of doing that. It's not always easy. And to be fair, some of my music doesn't really lend itself to audiences leaping about. But that's what I've been thinking about recently, because I'm always thinking about stuff. Yeah. Not always what I should be thinking about, but yeah, I'm always thinking about stuff. So there we have it. What? You want another story? Are you people never satisfied? Okay, and this is part 3 of Aurelian. What have we done? Horatio paused in the middle of the essential task of cleaning his tail and gave Aurelian an old-fashioned look. We didn't do anything. You invited a guest for Christmas Day, which is why you are tidying the flat. Now, if you'll excuse me, these knots won't work themselves loose. You were there, though. You could have stopped me. How? I didn't know you were going to ask him to spend the day with us. And once you'd done it, I couldn't very well say anything, could I? Aurelian slammed a book down on the desk, then groaned as the pile of unmarked essays tilted, began to slide, and then cascaded onto the floor. Horatio watched him scrabbling about on the carpet and swearing. He wondered if Aurelian would bang his head on the desk as he tried to stand up, decided it was inevitable, and trotted through to the relative safety of the bathroom, where he curled up on the laundry pile and went to sleep. Aurelian sat down, rubbing the back of his head and waiting for the points of light to stop dancing in front of his eyes. It's not as if he didn't like Theo. So why was he so upset about the man coming over for Christmas dinner? Well, apart from the need to tidy up and remember to wear trousers, there was nothing really. The level of conversation would be better, and Theo would bring good wine and good whiskey. Aurelian sneezed, too much dust in the air from the tidying up. He sneezed again and then tied the top of the bin bag and appraised his progress. The flat didn't look like a bomb had hit it, but only due to the lack of rubble and corpses. If anything, tidying up had made the place less tidy than it had been. The phone rang. Aurelian reached into his pocket and found it empty. He was still trying to remember where he'd put it down this time when the answer phone cut in. "This is Pepper, but I can't take the call at the moment. Please leave a message." "Beep!" "Aurelian, this is Andrea. We're having Christmas dinner for single members of staff at the Thrush and Thicket on the 25th, 1 o'clock sharp. I've got to confirm numbers this evening. If you don't get back to me, I'll have to assume you're not coming, but you'd better have a good excuse. Ciao for now." Click. Aurelian smiled. Maybe Christmas with Theo wasn't such a bad option after all. Well, I mentioned earlier on that I'm always thinking. And this is true, largely, especially when I'm trying to think. about things that I ought to be trying to think about. I end up thinking about everything else under the sun. And when I'm trying to sleep, when thinking just takes over and gets in the way if I'm not careful. One of the things I've been thinking about recently is tattoos. Now, some people like them, some people don't. My grandfather had two. And one was on his forearm, it was his old regimental crest. And the other was on his left knee, which was a beautiful butterfly. Now, the one on his forearm got exposed to the sun all the time. And it was done in 1919. So when I first saw it, which would have been about 1971, 72-ish, I should think, that I first really took notice and that there was a tattoo there, it was pretty well sun-faded and blurred. But the butterfly on his left knee, which I saw sometime later when he was persuaded to roll his trouser leg up and show me, was absolutely beautiful and pristine, which of course tells you that you do need to protect your tattoos from the sun if you have them. But I've been collecting them, and I have some terrible tattoos, and I have some beautiful tattoos, and it's funny how my affection for them isn't necessarily based on how good they are, because there's some of the terrible ones that I absolutely love. Well, no, to be fair, I love them all, and that's part of the point. Recently I've had some beautiful work done by a chap called John, who I taught when he was a sort of 14, 15 year old. I taught him biology and chemistry, and he is a superb artist, and a pretty fine musician actually as well. And he's recently done a beautiful anchor for me on my left arm, which wraps around with a ruined tower, and then a view across the sea with a beached rowing boat, looking across the water to a mountain, which is in fact Mount Taranaki in New Zealand, which is the most beautiful mountain I've ever seen. And I have seen it, otherwise I wouldn't have felt right putting it in, but yes, it's glorious. So at the moment I'm thinking about what we do next. So that's on my left forearm, and I've got large space on my right forearm, and we've been looking at pit vipers. I know not everyone likes snakes, but I happen to think they're exceptionally beautiful animals. Don't get me wrong, I'm scared to death of venomous snakes, and to be frank, of constrictors that are big enough to consider humans prey, which mostly is the larger anacondas and some of the very, very big pythons. Sort of 5-6 foot python is just a joy. But yeah, we've been looking at pit vipers, and I tell you, not only do they have really interesting looking heads, with things like projections that look like eyebrows and all sorts of things like that, but their scales are very beautifully defined, that's the word. I almost said designed then, defined. And they have amazing patterns across the different species of pit viper, and some of them are the most outrageous colours, which is fascinating. When you even sort of red and purple that appears to glow. So that's what we're looking at the moment, is wrapping a pit viper around my arm, probably starting with the head on my hand, and then working its way up, which I'm getting quite excited about. So that'll be now the beginning of September that we start work on that. So I'm looking forward to that enormously. At the same time, we're just going to put a little flying dragon above the ruined tower on my left arm, smaller than on the illustration on the front cover of The Hobbit, which is the one I had, that Tolkien did of Smaug being shot above Lake Town. Just a little silhouetted dragon flying above the ruined tower, because that'll be fun. Well, here comes some more of my cobbled together words. The boys are sparring with staves under the watchful eyes of a handful of grim-faced instructors. These men have served in armies from all over the world, all of them at the rank of sergeant or sergeant major. They set high standards and are very straightforward in their methods of enforcing those standards. Training is carried out with a degree of concentration that is often lacking in children of 14 or 15 years old. Three boys die in the first winter. They're quickly replaced by new recruits, each of whom has a mentor assigned to help him catch up with the training he's missed. If the new recruit fails to catch up fast enough, he and the mentor are both punished. It is, again, brutally simple and simply effective. I'm sparring with a new recruit. His father had the same name that I do, and his name is the same as my father's was. We find this grimly amusing. Both men are dead, and it becomes a long-running joke, if it can be called a joke, that we have taken the place of each other's fathers. He has a tendency to overextend his thrusts, leaving him off balance and vulnerable to being swept, knocked down with a blow to the head or tripped. That we're spiring on the icy surface of a frozen lake with treacherously slippery underfoot conditions makes issues of balance all the more crucial. On the fifth time I spend him sprawling, a sand timer is turned over and we're both sent to run around the perimeter of the lake. We have to return before the sun runs out or worse punishments will ensue. We both know this and drive each other on, arriving back at the instructor with very nearly a fifth of the sand remaining. At his curt nod, we return to sparring. I tries to expose his fault again. The instructors have left everyone in no doubt that going easy on an opponent will not be tolerated. This time, however, he is more controlled. And though he does still overextend a couple of times, he recovers himself in time to block my attempts to take advantage. On the third time he does it, I only just notice in time that it's a feint. I've always been fast. Some of the boys have even muttered that I'm too fast. On this occasion, I'm only just fast enough. The instructor appears, if not satisfied, at least no longer displeased. The instructor's favourite game is something we call sudden attack. One of them will pick at a target while we're doing something else and launch a surprise assault with a staff. The victim has to defend himself with whatever he has to hand. Several boys died in the early days, and we all learnt to be prepared to defend ourselves at any time. There were even a couple of attacks in the dormitory at night. Now the game has changed. 10 of us sprang to the defence of the target of a sudden attack and the trainer was killed. The other trainers seemed unconcerned by the death of one of their colleagues. But now a sudden attack is launched as a group assault and the resultant fighting is brought to a halt by a series of sharp blasts on the whistle. Since the change, nobody has died. But there have been a number of broken bones and some lost teeth. Amongst all the combat skills we are learning, there's a lot of emphasis on hunting and trapping, constructing shelters, moving quietly and remaining unseen. We are learning also to plot and execute ambushes, how to defend against them, and how to use the ground to our best advantage. We do not question what we are learning or why we're learning it. It does not even occur to us to do so. Each new skill is instead a challenge, something to learn and master as quickly and thoroughly as possible. I do not know how long I've been training. It is the entirety of our lives and we are proud because our prince is with us. The prince has us all lined up in pairs in front of a brazier which has a handle poking out of the top. The farm boys amongst us recognise it as a branding iron, like you use on cows, to show which farmer they belong to. The prince talks, fairly briefly, about the old gods of the Isles and how they are the true gods of our people, and the newer religion that the priesthood have brought to our lands have no relevance to us. We've heard it before, and few, if any of us, are really interested. But we pay close attention because it's ingrained in us now to do so. After the speech, the prince and his partner, who must have been briefed beforehand, strip off their tunics and proceed to brand each other at the top of the left arm. We come forward, one pair at a time, and follow suit, branding each other at the top of the left arm with the symbol the prince tells us is an ancient image of one of the old gods. None of us can work out which one it's supposed to be. But neither do any of us think that it's particularly important. It seems much more important to us that nobody cried out in pain, and not one of us flinched. We have been well and thoroughly trained. The prince tells us that we now bear the same mark. We are truly the Hundred. We cheer. It appears that the Isles have been targeted for invasion by the ever-expanding Balinese Empire. The king has called in the clans and plans to drive them back into the sea. The prince has a plan to use the Hundred to make sure that happens. He says it will also show people in the Isles that the old gods are real and that the Hundred are worthy of their legacy. He says it will also ensure that the Isles move into an era of prosperity that we have never dreamed to dream of. We aren't particularly worried about the old gods, or even about an era of prosperity. Instead, we continue to go through our training with care and concentration. Nothing else is really important to us. We're moving through a cave system. We are stripped down to the minimum, with our essentials carefully wrapped in oilskin packs. We have several sections of tunnels to negotiate, underwater, so the packs have to be as slim and as waterproof as we can possibly make them. If a man's pack gets snagged, it's quite probable that it would cause him to drown, and possibly the one or two men following him. The chill of the water is brutal, and we spend a lot of time rubbing each other down to restore warmth to our limbs once we're back on solid ground. We're carrying two-handed swords. We wouldn't be able to carry shields through the tunnels anyway, for much the same reason the nearest thing to armour we're carrying are oiled leather vests. Balinese infantry carry a large shield and a heavy short sword and wear a steel helmet and a mail shirt. At least we don't have to carry our food with us. That and other essential supplies have been stashed in the caves over the last few weeks. The journey is gruelling, and a fair bit of it is carried out in darkness. We are cold and clammy all the time and as tired as we've ever been. But we are the Hundred, and we have our prince with us. Our scouts have come back through the final water-filled tunnel. We have accomplished our journey in good time. It appears that the Balinese scouts have found and explored the cave that we will assemble in, but have ignored the flooded tunnel and left, apparently happy that no soldiers are hiding there. It is night now, and the Balinese army itself is camped a good mile further on, near to the village of Gatherbrook. There's a collection of campfires some distance beyond the encampment, suggesting that the clans of the Isles will give battle in the morning. We make our way through the final stretch of underwater tunnel. This time the cold does not seem as bad, but we chafe the warmth back into each other's limbs as before, then undo our packs and check over our equipment. Once we are all satisfied that we are properly prepared, we arrange ourselves into closely huddled groups and get as much sleep as we can, while the designated guards keep watch. Tomorrow may well see us all dead, or famous, or both. But that doesn't seem to be weighing on anyone's mind. We are here. We are doing what we've been trained to do. And in the morning we will again what we've been trained to do. It is that simple. The day dawns overcast and dull. Well, this is a good thing for us. We eat the last of our rations, then the scouts go out and the rest settle down to wait. I leave the cover of the cave with the other scouts. We wear our leather coats with the hoods up. They're in various shades of brown and grey and have thickening plates over vital areas, but leave us free to move. The breeze, faint as it is coming to us from the north, bringing with it the scents of wood smoke and cooking from the encampments. The Balinese scouts are out and about, but they are easily avoided. They appear almost arrogant in their lack of care. It is as if they believe that nothing can threaten their all-conquering troops, and scouting is something to do because it's in the manual, rather than because it has any importance. Our scouts are taking things very seriously, and are coming and going with information in silent relays, keeping the prince constantly updated. I'm on point duty, the furthest forward of our scouts, and not part of the constant relay. Occasionally one of our scouts works his way forward to receive information from me by hand gestures. Our scouts are maintaining strict silence. This is in total contrast to the Balinese scouts. One of them urinates in a bush, not 3 feet from me. He's looking back over his shoulder, laughing and joking with his mates. If I want to, I can count the hairs on the back of his hand. But he has no inkling that I am there. After about an hour or so, trumpets are blown in the Balinese camp and the troops begin to form up and file out of camp towards the ridge that the prince has said they will occupy. The Balinese right is being pushed back under the weight of the great levy in the Lords of the Central Isles. We watch enthralled as a great whoop goes up and Tybor the Bold unleashes his fearless men. Naked but for their boots and painted all over in red and black swirls, many of them frothing at the mouth, they hurl themselves against the end of the Balinese line, twin swords whirling. With their right already under pressure, the Balinese general commits his reserve to that flank. He has acted decisively, and the Balinese left stabilises, and then even begins to push the Islesmen back. It's our moment, and we know it. The order is never given. We're off at speed. 100 young men drawn up in a single tight wedge, with our prince at the point. We charge, in total silence, and crash into the rear of the Emperor's guard, where their lightly armoured archers have not seen us coming, and die like wheat under a scythe. The point of the wedge is driven in, and now we drive outwards, causing as much chaos and disruption in the Balinese formation as we can. At close range we've been taught to use our two-headed swords like a short staff, with a mace on one end and a dagger on the other. I drive the pommel up into the face of the man in front of me, block his short sword thrust with a sideways jab and stab him in the foot. He goes down and another downwards jab finishes him off. Then I sweep up at the groin of the man behind him. We have an initial advantage as the guardsmen struggle to turn with their shields in close quarters, and we're able to get in our three-man blows, pommel to the face or throat, upward slash at the groin and downward jab at the feet. These are professional soldiers, though, and they have the advantages of numbers and armour. The whole world consists of a semicircle of about 3 feet in front of me, and instinct and training control my movements. Then the press gets too tight, and I take my right hand off the sword and draw a knife in the sheath strapped to my left forearm as we push and shove and stab and jab. Then I feel a tremendous blow to the side of my head, a flash of light, and briefly, the knowledge that I am falling.
Well, I'm sitting in the garden again. Jen is just starting to harvest her potatoes, which is going to be exciting. Well, I hope it's going to be exciting. Looks like there ought to be a reasonable crop. But you never really know with potatoes. They're quite odd. So yeah, this is going to be exciting. I hope you've enjoyed what we've done so far. I'm in a happy place. I'm actually going to be meeting up with a friend tonight, All socially distanced, obviously. But it'll be lovely to see him. I haven't seen him for ages. So that's, you know, it's kind of that lovely feeling of getting back to normal with at the same time the feeling I have to still maintain my discipline and be a good boy. But anyway, it's been a good week. I hope you've had a good week too. This has been, well, I'll let the music tell you. That was Between Mountains and Sea, a podcast dealing with what it's like to be a creative person living in North West Wales.